800-686-2237. That's 800-686-2237.
Now you can bring Berkey purification power anywhere with the Sport Berkey filtration bottle. Ideal for sporting games, camping or boating, or Sport Berkey is small enough to store in your glove box, so it's ideal backup for unexpected emergencies like blackouts, floods, or earthquakes. It's simply the best personal water filtration system available. So effective you can drink raw, untreated water from lakes, rivers, and streams. Unlike other sport bottles, the Sport Berkey's patented filter formulation is so powerful it removes cysts, parasites, harmful bacteria, and chemicals like herbicides and
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Dr. Paul Gottfried, who is a professor of humanities. He's had a fascinating life. He's written extensively about the conservative movement. He's met a lot of very fascinating people, and he's written a book called Encounters. And it's certainly a sort of autobiographical, but it's not a complete autobiography. It's simply about his encounters with some of the people who have changed the world in which we live. Dr. Gottfried, thank you so very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Well, it's a pleasure. We had Dr. Gottfried once before, but I really wanted all of our listeners to hear what he had to say because, of course, he's met the leaders of the left, the right, and of course, a lot of people in between, and this is what his book really covers. And, of course, one of the most significant of your relationships was a relationship with Richard Nixon. How did you happen to meet, of all people, Richard Nixon?
Well, I first learned about his interest in my work after reading, it may have been the American Spectator back in 1986 or 87. I think it may have been 1987, and he said that my book, The Search for Historical Meaning, which had appeared shortly before, was his favorite book of the year. And I took the occasion to get in touch with his secretary and see if I could meet him. He invited me to his office, which was in northern New Jersey at the time, and we had a number of interesting conversations. He then invited me to dinner at his home twice, one time I was able to invite other guests to come, and I found him one of the most intelligent people I've ever met. One of the points that I stress in my book is that he was entirely different in personal conversation from the very stiff image that he projected as a public figure. He was never at a loss for words. His speech sort of flowed from him, almost a kind of natural cadence. He sort of peppered his conversation with interesting jokes and allusions. And I was really struck by his intelligence and by how different he was from the Richard Nixon that I'd seen on television.
Well, certainly he was very, very well-read, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, which was something that surprised me. His training was actually in law, and he had finished his degree at Duke University. There was, however, a professor of legal theory named Lone Fuller who had influenced him deeply, and Fuller was interested in the history of political theory and got Nixon, apparently, to read a number of important works. He had read Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan. He had read Hegel's Philosophy of Right. And I was struck by how much he had read and how much he was able to recall. The other thing that I found fascinating was his ability to talk about international relations. He could, you know, just pick out a country and describe all of its political problems and how the United States must deal with its government in the foreseeable future, what our long-term relations with this country might look like. He was usually right, as far as I could determine by looking at these countries afterwards and studying their histories. But he had an enormous command of information.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Paul Gottfried, who's professor of humanities. He's written a fascinating book. He's written a lot of books on the conservative movement and certainly on the political philosophy. I think having read it, it's more or less more conservative than liberal. But this book we're talking about is called Encounters. And it goes into his relationship with a number of the key people who actually shaped the world in which we live today. And one of them, of course, was Richard Nixon. And Dr. Gottfried has simply been telling us about Richard Nixon and really how unusual he was. Now, this is, of course, after Nixon had left the White House. This was in the 1980s. And, of course, he's now in his retirement. But well, Professor Gottfried, who obviously has written many books himself and has read extensively, was quite impressed by Richard Nixon's grasp of history and politics and really, of course, the various nations of the world. Did Richard Nixon ever talk to you about the ruling elite at all, at least at one point in one of his books? He talked about, you know, the people who really control the media, who control the reality of the average American. Did he ever talk a little bit about the people who seem to run things behind the scenes or the people who really manipulated him out of office, because that was obviously a very well-constructed effort to depose a president of the United States?
He was surprisingly reticent about that subject, and the few times I tried to introduce that theme into a conversation, you know, he very quickly deflected my initiative and went back to some other subject that he preferred, felt more comfortable discussing. I do agree with you that he, you know, he had long-term enemies who were, you know, wanted to push him out of the White House, and I think this is, like, as I indicate in my chapter on Nixon, this is one of the tragedies of his life, that he could never quite escape these enemies, and I really don't think he was paranoid. I think those enemies were there. He might have been a bit more clever or a bit more tactful in handling them, but sooner or later he would have to face a confrontation with these people. Many of them went back the 1950s, when Nixon made a reputation as an anti-communist. And if there's one thing which his opponents were not, was anti-communist, and to some extent they held it against him, that he had, I suppose from their position, sort of sharpened or aggravated the confrontation between the United States and communist powers.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Gottfried, Dr. Stan, and our guest is Dr. Paul Gottfried, who actually was talking about his encounters with Richard Nixon. He visited him a number of times, had dinner with him several times, and because, of course, Richard Nixon, I think, really always wanted to be in touch with people who really, of course, had a great deal of intelligence and a great deal of knowledge, and even though he himself was a very, very smart man, I have a feeling, having read a certain amount about him, that he liked to be associated with people that he felt really, of course, had an influence on what was going on in the world. But Dr. Gottfried is just saying that he had tried to bring up the matter of, you know, the effort, the organized effort to impeach Richard Nixon. He actually resigned so he wouldn't be impeached. But, you know, when you actually can create such a furor that you can force a sitting president to resign, and of course, I think Dr. Gottfried would admit there was an organized effort to get rid of Nixon. But he was just saying that certainly some of these people really first went back to the 1950s when Richard Nixon made a reputation for himself as a staunch anti-communist, and he was sort of never forgiven for that. Would that be a fair appraisal?
It'd be entirely fair appraisal. If you read a chapter of my book, this is precisely the point that I make. There was also something else which I found almost endearing about Nixon. He was really not Tricky Dick. He was not a particularly tricky person. He was rather straightforward. And I think it's one of the things that brought him down was that he could not dissemble his dislike for his enemies, for his sworn enemies. And this came out in his conversation. He would get angry when he would talk about them while he was president. It's interesting that in 1960, Kennedy probably won the presidential election as a result of dishonesty. Mayor Daley of Chicago may well have stolen the election by delivering fraudulent vote returns for the state of Illinois. And it was a very close election. It was only about 260,000 votes separating the two candidates. And Nixon was asked, you know, why did you ask for a recount? And his response at the time was, well, it would be divisive for the nation. And he told me that the reason is that he simply, you know, that given the excitement of the time, he had forgotten to ask for a recount, or did never enter his mind to ask for the recount. And of course, if you go back to the 2000 election, I mean, the Democrats had an entire team of lawyers in Florida, and they were disputing every ballot that was cast and so forth. Well, Nixon was not clever this way. And, you know, he probably thought, well, I lost the election and I'm not going to bother go back and you know, worry about the spilled milk. And, you know, he told me that he had sort of forgotten to ask for the recount. I think in reality, he just didn't want to be bothered after he lost the race. And I think to some extent he was genuinely bothered by the fact that the same people who had hated him in the 1950s continued to hate him into the 1970s, although he had tried to work for peaceful relations with the Soviet Union and with China. And it sort of opened the door to, you know, dealing with communist China at the time. But, you know, the impression I think that he had was that his enemies were just unforgiving because he had been the one who had gone after Alger Hiss in the 1950s and had revealed this high-ranking member of the State Department, you know, as having been a communist agent, which Hiss definitely was. I think the anti-communist could never forgive Nixon for doing that. The other thing is, as president, he was fairly liberal in most of the social economic policies, but this really bought him no favor with his enemies. It could not make up, I think, in their minds for the reputation that he had earned in the 1950s, which they held against him.
Did he ever talk about his relationship with Henry Kissinger?
That did not come up very much in conversation. Now, I have to say that although I put something in my autobiography, which I recommend to all of your listeners, I put something there about Kissinger. I think Kissinger was not a very gracious or grateful beneficiary of the kindness of Richard Nixon, and spoke about him badly after Kissinger had left the Nixon administration. Perhaps he was hoping to get a job with the with some later administration, with the Reagan administration. But he generally treated Nixon condescendingly, gave Nixon very little credit for a foreign policy which both of them had devised together, which may really have been more Nixon's idea to start with. So I think Nixon was properly irritated by Kissinger's behavior, but in any case, he didn't speak about it very much in my presence.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, of course, he was very gracious and certainly was not the sort of ogre we've been led
Absolutely
to believe.
Absolutely not.
All right, fine. Well, then, of course, you encountered other people. One of them was a man named Herbert Marcuse. Now, Herbert Marcuse is about as far to the left as you can possibly get. So why would a gentleman such as yourself with certain conservative philosophical leanings be attracted to Marcuse?
Well, he was my professor in graduate school at Yale, and I learned a great deal from him. And when he was talking about a field like European intellectual history, or the history of Western thought, he was remarkably objective, and even showed appreciation for profoundly conservative historical figures. In any case, I saw nothing of the crazy side of him, which came out when he moved to your part of the country.
Well, I had nothing to do with that. Now, go ahead.
Well, no, but I mean, when he went out to San Diego, he obviously went up the deep end. Now, I try to explain that in my chapter of Marcuse, that this may have come out of frustration, the fact that Yale did not provide him with a chair when he was being sort of eased out at Brandeis. I think he had probably reached retirement age, but they probably didn't want to keep him any longer than the age of 65. I think he was 64 or 65 when I had him as a professor. But what I saw of him was not the crazy aspect, which became all too clear once he had left the East and moved out to California. I knew nothing about Angela Davis. Most of what I saw of him in class seemed to be, you know, rather reasonable. And you know, as I point out in the chapter on Marcuse, He had very sort of almost instinctively conservative social views. He had no understanding of the feminist movement. Something like the gay movement would have struck him as, you know, as totally absurd. At the time of the Griswold case in Connecticut, which went back to, I think, to 65, when they sort of created a situation with the selling of contraceptives that would result in a Supreme Court case. It was all carefully, you know, constructed in order to create a situation that would then be taken up as a judicial matter by the courts. And this was taking place maybe a few hundred feet from where our class met in New Haven, Connecticut. And someone was trying to explain the implications to him, and he just shrugged his shoulders. I mean, he couldn't care less. I remember one of my classmates was a feminist. He thought she was, you know, totally mad. So I think all of this speaks very well for Marcuse. Although he was a cultural Marxist, he was not as crazy as the current American left.
Well, because I think that a lot of people who embrace socialism are truly idealistic. I know, Chris, I was 16 when I entered college, and I was pretty well programmed in socialism, you know, when I was there by my professors, and they certainly rewarded you when you supported the Marxist position and punished you when you didn't, and I wasn't smart enough at the time to realize what was happening.
Right.
Chris, you are idealistic. You want to help people. You recognize as the... certainly the problems in our society and the danger of certainly of the ruling elite, and so you want to correct that. I think their concerns should be universal. It's only their solutions that I very much disagree with.
Yeah, well, I actually at the time I was a very right-wing Republican. I don't think I ever went through this idealistic socialist phase.
Well, you're much smarter than I was.
I don't know, but I mean, but still, Marcuse knew what my views were, but he still gave me honors in the course. Now, this would not have been the case if I were studying with the standard liberal professors of the era. If I had Richard Hofstadter as a professor, or Peter Gay, or any of these liberal types, I'm sure they would have treated me very badly in their classes. So in that respect, I think, although he may occasionally have defended Joseph Stalin, but at least in that respect, he was more tolerant than the liberals of my day.
Well, I think many people, of course, could not believe that Stalin was the monster that he was. They felt it was all propaganda. That mm-hmm. you know, and then you had to. After all, it was for a noble purpose. Maybe we could justify a few excesses. I see this in a lot of the conservatives today, as we look and see what's going on throughout the world, and they can justify all sorts of things because, of course, the end justifies the means.
Yeah.
I do not believe that for 1 minute. I mean, you have to stand on what's right, but what is righteous, and there is a right and a wrong, but so many people will justify the wrong simply because for a greater purpose.
Well, you know, I actually, on this matter, I think there is absolutely no excuse for Americans such as the historian Eric Foner, who's now like the leading American historian and has an endowed chair at Columbia. People like him, his family, who defended Stalin's mass murders, crimes, and claimed they were doing it because they were interested in Negro civil rights. This was their excuse. There was no way you could not have known that Stalin killed even more people than Hitler. So I find very little excuse, you know, in retrospect, for these people who spent their lives justifying Soviet crime.
Yeah, I agree with you totally. I mean, it's so horrible when we stop and think about it, and yet, of course, most of this is covered up, very seldom talked
yes,
about
is.
America, and that's one of the great problems we have, is that most people do not understand the enormity of the evil that exists in the world today. We'll be right back here with Dr. Paul Godfrey. Well, who were some of the other people that really impressed you in your travels and in your time?
Well, I don't know. There's a whole bunch of other people that we can discuss who appear there. One of them is actually a Californian, originally Robert Nisbet, famous social theorist, profoundly conservative social theorist, whose critiques of the United States, written in the early 1950s. Describe the America that we're living through right now. And Nisbet is one of the most remarkable social critics produced by the United States. Also a person who succeeded professionally. I mean, he was the Albert Schweitzer professor at Columbia. He taught many years in Riverside in California before going to the East. Another person I discuss is Eugene Genovese, who was then sort of a Marxist historian when I knew him, and then finally moved to the right, became very conservative, very Catholic. But when I knew him, he was a Marxist. And he's one of the most fascinating social historians produced by the United States. Who else is in that book? Christopher Lash, another important social figure. Lash is often identified with the left because he's a critic of capitalism, but his social views are profoundly conservative. And I write about my experiences with Lash. Lash and Genovese both were professors at Rochester, and Genovese tried to get me a position there when I was 30 years old. He failed because Lash opposed me and opposed him. Although both of them became my friends later on. I'm trying to think of some of the other figures in the book. Well, one of them is a very sad figure, Sam Francis, who is very, very sort of profoundly reactionary social figure, very critical of just about everything that happened in the United States in the 1960s, 1970s. He was a brilliant journalist who died in his 50s after leading a very sad life and being kicked out of a number of important journalistic positions. He's probably the saddest figure in that book. Another one is Pat Buchanan, who is obviously well known to many of your listeners, who is a very flamboyant journalist and a kind of in-your-face conservative. I've known Pat for many years. In the book I talk about my experiences following his presidential campaign in 1992. Needless to say, he lost, you know, after sort of scaring the Republican establishment. He's a very interesting figure who sort of never lets up. I mean, he'll continue going after the same enemy, you know, even though it becomes apparent that that he's endangering his own position. And I, as I indicate, I sort of share that characteristic with Pat.
Well, you have to do what's right, and just because you're losing, just because other people can't see the truth,
right.
You can't back away from it. I mean, what we're talking about is the very survival of Western civilization. Western civilization is crumbling today, and I don't know whether it can be saved, but I do know that I have the greatest respect for Pat Buchanan because he always has the same thing, and he
right.
stands for certain things, and I appreciate a man who stands for something. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest today is Dr. Paul Gottfried, who's written a number of books. You grew up on Wikipedia and listed the list of all the books he's written. But this latest book, Encounters, something gives his impression of some of the people that we know or that we know of, certainly of Richard Nixon and Marcuse, but he's been talking about Pat Buchanan, a man who in many respects almost seems to be tilting at windmills, and yet a man, of course, who stood for certain things, has continues to stand for them. He was critical of NAFTA when it went in. He says it's going to take our jobs, are going to be our jobs are going overseas. He was absolutely right. Our jobs are going overseas, and they're not coming back again. And as a result of this, I think that the America we have known is going to change forever. You can't have a recovery from an economic recession without jobs. You can't have jobs without credit. You can't get credit because the banks aren't lending. And the banks aren't lending because they're going along with this agenda of shipping our jobs overseas. It's going on right now. And I see I think America is going to change and change dramatically. And that's what Pat Buchanan was talking about, back in the 1990s when they brought in NAFTA and everybody scoffed at him.
Are you asking me this as a question?
Well, yes, I want your comments because I sometimes, this is what I do. I make a statement, then if you disagree with me, you go right ahead.
Yeah, I think that... there are pluses, there are positive and negative sides of NAFTA. One could say that on balance, it probably hasn't cost us that many jobs. And what I think it has done is to make drug traffic easier than it had been before. We're getting a lot of drugs. Also, it created a kind of laxity for a long time about illegal immigration. Because after all, we were dealing, we had a free trade zone, and we weren't going to look too carefully if people, were coming across the border with their goods to trade in the United States. I think some of the implications of NAFTA were bad. Another thing Buchanan has complained about is the outsourcing, and he may, in fact, be right that, in balance, we're not going to benefit from the outsourcing of jobs. We're going to lose jobs. But I think there the jury may still be out. What I do admire about him is that he sticks with positions, and many of the positions that he takes are not popular positions. And he gets beaten up by the liberal neoconservative press in the United States, the same press which totally ignores all my books, including this book, and they won't even review it. They review nothing that comes from me. They generally try not to review Pat. Occasionally they do, and they beat up on him, but he still keeps coming at them. And I admire that tenacity. In the book I say that there's a kind of imprudence or boldness which Aristotle thought was not necessarily a virtue. It was an excess. But in Pat's case, I actually admire this excess. Because, as you said, I think somebody has to stand up and say that we're doing everything the wrong way, we're going in the wrong direction. And I think he's been fearless in doing that.
Well, I'll tell you what, meeting him and hearing him talk is it really was one of the high points of my life. I'll never forget. We were interviewing a number of the Republican candidates for the presidency in 1999. There was a group of about 25 Christian leaders, and we were interviewing them. And the last day, we'd done this several days, the last day, there was George Bush and Pat Buchanan. And somebody asked Pat Buchanan a question. He talked for 20 minutes on this. A beautifully constructed presentation. I've forgotten what it was. I really think it was dealing with NAFTA, what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And then we talked to George Bush, and his answers were all canned. They were maybe three or four sentences. That was it. Somebody asked him what he thought about the Constitution and whether he would actually sign a bill that was unconstitutional. He said, I don't understand the question. And it was amazing to me that the difference between the two. They were both running for the Republican nomination at that time, and of course George Bush got it, and the man who I thought was so far superior, everybody scoffed at. Well, our guest is certainly Dr. Paul Gottfried. If you're out there in the listening audience, let me recommend this is a fascinating book. It's just a nice book to read, a lot of insight into people and philosophy. And when we get back, if you'd like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And give us a call. And of course, when we get back, we'll let you know where you can get the book at Dr. Gottfried's website. A man who's been on the front lines of this philosophical battle for really the conservative survival of our way of life for many, many years. And fighting in the university system that doesn't necessarily take too well to it.
No.
This is Dr. Stan. Of course, our guest is Dr. Paul Gottfried, and we're talking about his book, Encounters. And, of course, he has written extensively on the conservative philosophy. And as a university professor in the universities today, very, very few really staunch conservatives in the university system. Would that be a fair appraisal?
Yes. I think, if anything, it's an understatement.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. I guess is Dr. Paul Gottfried, and he certainly has had a fascinating life and met so many of the really important people. And before I go on, do you have a website? And tell people where they can get copies of your book.
Well, the easiest way to get it is over Amazon.com. Look under Encounters or Paul Gottfried, G-O-T-T-F-R-I-E-D. I am very eager to sell books because, as I indicated, the book has not fared as well as I was hoping it would, because the usual people, the usual suspects, did not review it. It is an extremely good read. It is everything that has been described as being on this program, and it is available on Amazon.com. The publisher is Intercollegiate Studies Institute, ISI. And they will be very happy to send copies of the book to whoever would like to order it.
All right, fine. Well, it is a good read, and it just gives fascinating insight into many of these people. Now, you, of course, write about Murray Rothbard. Mm-hmm. Who was Murray? Why was he so important? And today, Murray has passed on, but he certainly was a giant in the conservative, or I should say the libertarian movement.
Yeah,
they shouldn't mix these terms up, but he was a true libertarian.
Yeah, he was. He also, I think, sort of went through a number of phases in his life which make him, you know, a fact that makes him even more interesting. I mean, there are tirades that he wrote against, you know, the war in Vietnam that make him sound like a far leftist, and for a while he even tried to collaborate with the left, the kind of anti-war movement. On the other hand, he supported Strom Thurmond for president in 1948, who was running on the Dixiecrat ticket. His view of the United States is that it was really sort of conceived in liberty, that most powers which the federal government had taken in the 20th century were not only unconstitutional, they also went against the intention, you know, of those who made the American Revolution and intended to create a society based on freedom. Beside being an historian of liberty, of American liberty, he was an important economist, Murray, and he was the person who perhaps did more than anyone else to bring the Austrian School of Economics to the United States. His fertility as a writer, or productiveness as a writer, is unbelievable. I mean, it would take, you know, you can fill a whole library with books that he wrote. And the range of his writing is remarkable, because besides writing very technical, abstruse treatises on economic problems, cash flow, or things like this. He also wrote movie reviews. He wrote amusing political satires. He was a very gifted journalist, in addition to being a mathematician and an economic a scholar of economics. And he wrote on ethics. He wrote on history. He also just about broke from every conservative movement that he'd been associated with in the course of his life, and finally landed up, say, you know, creating his own movement of libertarians. The libertarians who followed Rothbard, though, I think, are of a more socially traditional kind. I mean, they're economic libertarians, but they generally tend to be culturally conservative.
I think that's an excellent analysis of it. And, of course, his things are still available on the Internet, well worthwhile reading. And unless people understand Austrian economics, they can't understand why we're in the quicksand today. And the more we struggle, the deeper we go. But certainly the Austrian... Could you tell our listeners just a little bit about this concept of Austrian economics?
Yeah,
because I don't think a lot of them really understand it.
Right. Now, there is, one might say, a disciple of Rothbard, Thomas Woods, did a book on the economic meltdown that became a bestseller, and his work is really sort of derivative from Murray's work. What sort of sets the Austrian school apart, beside the fact that they developed in Vienna in the late 19th and early 20th century, is the rejection of mathematical models and economics. My oldest daughter is a mathematical economist, and when you talk about Austrian economics, she just shrugs her shoulder, because the Austrian economists are not particularly interested in using mathematical models or mathematical projections, since they believe that that you cannot predict economics. Economic decisions are made by individuals on the basis of their rational self-interest, what they perceive as their rational self-interest at the time, and that the closest thing one might say to a system of economic justice comes with a pricing system, because prices indicate what something is worth to those who want to buy it, right? So you don't need the government determining what the price will be. The price sets itself as a result of economic transaction. The Austrian economists also assume that if you are buying something, you have a need for it, the government cannot, you know, determine this need. You have to determine it for yourself. So that the government really is not in a position to set what are rational economic priorities. Much of what economists would say is rational, the Austrian economists we reject as irrational, because it is based on a view of knowledge at the top, which is simply not available. It is you know, a series, or I might say a kind of collection of discrete economic decisions made by individuals who are negotiating with each other that determines the value of something.
Well, of course, the problem is that if these economists are so smart, why are we in such a mess today? I mean, these are the people who've been in charge, and whether it was the Alan Greenspan or the
right.
Dr. Bernanke, certainly. I mean, they got us into the mess we are, and how are they going to get us out? Because they're doing exactly what got us into the mess.
Right. Well, this, I think, is the argument of the Austrian school. Somebody like Ron Paul is heavily influenced by the Austrian school. He's, you know, a disciple of theirs. And his criticism of the Federal Reserves, of the use of the government use of credit, and the monetary system, just creating money without a gold standard. Ron Paul has argued, as did Murray Rothbard and Tom Woods, have created the crisis that we're now facing. What you have really is, you know, too much government, or government authorizing credit that should not be available, and using monetary supply as a way of shaping the parameters of the economy. So the Austrian school is really on top of this. They also totally reject the Federal Reserve system. They believe in the gold standard, returning to something which is the equivalent of the gold standard. Where a system in which money would be backed up by something real.
Well, what we have is an imaginary financial system.
It is.
The trouble is that most people don't understand it's imaginary, and they really think money has value, but mm-hmm. they don't understand, of course, right now, of course, they're just pumping out money like it's going out of style. We have no idea how much they've turned out or where it's gone, and Ben Bernanke assures us that he's got to be able to take care of this before the whole system collapses. But what happens if he's wrong? And then nobody ever asked that.
I suspect he's wrong.
I do, too.
I also have not been able to figure out how this medical plan, which will probably cost trillions of dollars, is going to help revive us economically.
Well, basically, Barack Obama said that if we will just suddenly extend medical coverage to people, 46 million Americans, we're going to save money. In fact, we don't have this new medical plan, well, there's no way we'll ever balance the budget.
Yeah,
and
right.
I hear him talking, and I'm saying to myself, this is totally illogical babble. Does anybody understand what he's saying?
Well, I don't think people necessarily, you know, understand. But they buy into this because they think they're going to get economic coverage without any cost to themselves, medical coverage without any kind of cost to themselves. And I think the ones to whom this is particularly appealing are younger people who probably make up a disproportionate number of those who are not insured because they just don't take medical insurance. But if the government gives it to them for free, in quotation, you know, then they're willing to accept it. And therefore, they really don't care very much about the figures that Bernanke or Obama juggle around on TV.
Well, I think that the problem is that, of course, when it's free, why, of course, people tend to abuse it, they tend to... And so the only way to make the system work will be to ration access to health care, and this is what's happened in every country.
Yes, it will. That's inevitable. The other problem is that Americans think they can get the high quality of health care, which Americans have, while paying less money. There was a very good article by Thomas Sowell on this, pointing out that... when people say they want a house, they don't mean the house that existed in the year 1800. They want a house with air conditioning, centralized heating. The same thing is true about medicine, he points out, that people don't want mere medicine or medical treatment as it existed 50 or 100 years ago. They want state-of-the-art medicine, but they don't want to pay for it. They want the government to pay for it or somebody else to pay for them.
People have... really do not understand that there is no free lunch. And a government that can provide everything you want has got to be able to take whatever you have, and a government that can provide you from the cradle to the grave has got to be able to control you from the cradle to the grave. It is so elementary. It's so simple. Why can't the average individual understand that these socialist programs don't work?
Well, there's two reasons. First of all, they're so controlled by the government right now that, you know, the government determines political correctness, the government determines who you hire, or who gets admitted to school, who is being discriminated against, all these other things. It also is taking a larger and larger share of our income. So that, you know, what we're talking about is simply a quantitative development or jump in the power of the, or leap in the power of the government over us. But it's already been going on for many, many years. So we're not talking about something that is entirely new. Second of all, many people just don't care. You know, I mean, I've noticed this as a college professor. If you ask students questions, they give you politically correct answers. Their minds have already been laundered by the media, by public education, and they don't value freedom very much, which I think is a major problem that those of us who think highly of freedom, you know, have to face.
Well, you know, I find that the people who really value freedom are the people who come from communist countries or who lived under the Nazis or come from China. They understand the importance of freedom, and we take it for granted.
That's right.
And you can't have freedom when you have a government that is actually providing whatever you want. So, well, if you're out there in the listening audience, we have, of course, somebody calling from Monterey here. Hi, okay. Do you have a question or comment for our guest? Oh, this is Rita.
Hello.
Yes, Rita. Do you have a question or comment for our guest?
I actually have a question. I don't know if you want to take this one right now or not, but I was wondering if you saw the article in the Monterey Herald about, I think it was Monday's or Friday's paper. I have it not with me at the moment, but I Xeroxed it. And it states that the United States gave $200 million just recently over to Palestine to help their government. I wondered if you had any comment on that.
I really don't. It's a little offline, but you could call us on Wednesday. We do an open line program on Wednesday, and that's Wednesday evening at 8 o'clock. Give us a call then. Okay, Rita?
All right, I'll do that.
Fine.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And, of course, I really would like to stay more or less on our subject here, which, of course, Dr. Paul Gottfried and the people that he has met, and we've talked about quite a few of them, Brother Nixon and Murray Rothbard and certainly Marcuse, and there's certainly a number of people that he had an opportunity to meet during his years as a professor. Are you retired at the present time?
Well, I'm semi-retired. I still teach. I teach half the time, but my teaching load has been vastly reduced since last year, which allows me to do things that I prefer to doing. The one course I enjoy teaching is classical Greek, But then, you know, there are not that many students who take it at our institution, and it's sort of hard to get them to move through the grammar book. But it gives me a chance to refresh my knowledge of the subject.
Well, of course, so much of our heritage, too many of our ideas came out of Greece and the writings of Plato and Socrates.
That's correct.
Well, I shouldn't say Socrates. I don't think we have anything he really
wrote. We know about it, we know through Plato.
Right, and of course Aristotle. Yeah. But of course these ideas are really the foundation of so much of what's going on today. In fact, if you look at Washington, D.C., I was just thinking the other day as I was looking at the pictures, so many of our major buildings there are patterned after the Greek architecture.
Well, what is very interesting to me is if you look at the history of American political rhetoric, in the 19th century, even into the 20th century, politicians were able to intersperse classical, biblical references with everything they said, and the listener would know what they were referring to. If you read Abraham Lincoln, he's constantly quoting the Bible. He sounds like a minister most of the time when he speaks. But then everybody read the Bible. He quotes Shakespeare. People read Shakespeare. There weren't that many books that were available, but everybody who was literate read them. Everyone who was literate read the Bible. They read the King James Bible, which is one of the great, besides being an important source of religious moral truth, it is one of the great literary works in the English language, or in any language, that people read this. They learn to read by reading the Bible. Most of the people I teach have absolutely no idea of what's in the Bible. You tell them, they don't know Bible stories. They know nothing about classical history. The cultural illiteracy in this country is absolutely appalling, and the politicians reflect it as well, right? I mean, you never hear Obama making a biblical reference of any kind. I don't think he ever read the Bible. I mean, what he knows about the Bible, he learned from Jeremiah Wright or somebody like that. But I mean, you don't hear people referring to this. I've never heard him referring to any classical text. He's basically the political counterpart of Oprah Winfrey. He sort of makes you feel good, tells you things you want to hear. Has a kind of relaxed delivery that people enjoy, but what he says has no content.
Well, you know, the great tragedy of today is that our young people do not know history. They don't understand the history of our nation. They don't understand, you know, what happened in Greece and Rome, which were really the foundation of the thought,
right?
Put forward by the people who created our nation, the only nation really where they've ever had where people could really be free, with the power of the government was be limited by the chains of the Constitution, because of course our founding fathers knew you couldn't trust men.
No.
And yet, and today, as we look and see what's happening, all power to government, we're going to take care of you, just give us your votes, and we'll look after you from the cradle to the grave.
They didn't trust men, but the men they had were of much greater stature than the political leaders we have today.
Hold that thought. Well, we have 3 minutes to wrap up the program. So would you like to give the thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners today?
Well, I suppose I should address myself to the sort of the issues brought up, the questions brought up in the book. And the book sort of ends sadly. It begins sadly and it ends sadly if you read it. I show that, you know, my career sort of never really takes off. And things in life sort of, I go back to back to the point at which I start, and I compare it to a railroad journey, in which you keep going back to the same point, your point of departure, and the conclusion of it also, deals with, critics of the present, or people who looked upon the age in which they were living. This was the 1980s, very pessimistically, and you know, sometimes I'm criticized for not showing the bright spots in my books, or things that are getting better and better. I think that I generally assume that we know those areas in which we've progressed. Obviously, technologically, medically, we have progressed. We are much better off than people were 100 years ago, and certainly much better off than people were 200 years ago. I would say in most other areas of human life, however, I see deterioration. Artistically, culturally, religiously, morally, even since the 1950s when I was a young man, it looks like the family is in wretched, in relatively wretched condition. Some of the things I hear about gay marriage, group marriage, I find myself, I'm not so much appalled as simply feeling more and more that I'm living on a different planet. I mean, I can't even relate to things that are now going on. And in some ways, it seems to me that the changes that have taken place in my life, many of them, I believe, are for the worse, are greater than the changes that occurred in the preceding 1,000 years. Certainly in terms of the attack on traditional social institutions. The fact that one has to justify gender roles, that one has to justify the existence of a heterosexual marriage, I find this extremely strange. And, you know, we finally find ourselves defending things that people in every society in the history of the human race just took for granted, but which now have become attacked as bigoted, obscurantist.
Hold that thought for just a moment here.
Go ahead.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest has been Dr. Paul Gottfried, and I'd love to go on for another hour, but I'm going to have to let you go. We're out of time, but I really appreciate so much of being with us, and God bless you. Thanks so much for being our guest.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Bye-bye. All right, fine, and let's just quickly go to Robert, who's calling from Iowa. Robert, did you have a quick question? Because we're out of time. Robert, are you there? Well, I guess we lost Robert. Well, anyway, I think that certainly we do carry the book that Dr. Gottfried was talking about, Meltdown by Dr. Thomas Wood. He's with the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Meltdown, if you want to understand philosophically and practically where we are and where we're going financially. This is a very current book written by one of my favorite guests, certainly right along with Dr. Gottfried. This is the second time we've talked to him, but we've had Dr. Wood on a number of times on other subjects. But his book, Meltdown, is must reading for people who want to understand what's going on. We carry the book Family of Secrets, goes into the background of the Bush family, all their secrets, the connection to the Central Intelligence Agency, and all the things that they don't want you to know about the family. And the family's been around, and it was, of course, the old Prescott Bush was, actually his firm was got into real trouble because they were helping to finance and maintain the finances of the Third Reich during the Second World War when they were killing our boys. We don't talk about that. But Family of Secrets is an excellent book. Let me recommend it to you. And then, of course, if you want, of course, to understand what is really going on, you need to get my talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness of the book, the talk on the Forbidden Secret and the syllabus, the talk on the Financial Armageddon and the syllabus goes with that. They're all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV, war. And then, of course, we recommend Patrick Wood's excellent DVD, The Trilateral Commission, because, of course, these are the people who are really running the world today, the Trilateral Commission. And let me suggest, of course, you can read about them in my newsletters. They're posted up on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com. We are entering a very difficult period in our nation's history. If you haven't, of course, laid in a supply of long-term storage food, let me suggest you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you a catalog. You need the Berkey water filter. You really need to lay in a supply of health products to keep your immune system up. You know, in case we really do have some sort of a contrived epidemic, who knows what they're going to do. But we do know that there's certain things will help you boost your immune system, like vitamin D3. And, of course, that's 5,000 units at least once a day. And certainly, whenever I'm coming down ill, I take them every 4 hours until I start feeling better, along with Allibiotic, which is simply an herbal medication with oil of oregano or oil of elderberry, garlic, and other things that really do seem to help. At least they help me, and this is why we carry them. And of course, we have a list of the various health products that we think are important that Barbara and I take. If you'd like the list, well, give us a call. Certainly, we carry Otterol, which is an iodine product, and it will, of course, load you with large doses of iodine, which are absolutely necessary. Most people are low on iodine, and of course, that's because they much of the salt or half the salt they've taken the iodine out of. Why would they do that? And then they've taken it out of our bread, and they've taken it out of our milk, which they used to add it to. Why would they do that? And that's why, of course, the people in Japan are consuming about, at least 10 times more iodine, and they're far healthier than the people here in the United States. So if you'd like to get information, we've got a great 4 tapes out on iodine and the iodine deficiency, which is so prevalent. Our telephone number, again, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com, where you can watch our DVDs, you can listen to our news programs, you can actually read our letters, they're all free, all sorts of essays and other things there, and then please pray for America, pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty.